You're listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska, K201DA in King Cove, Alaska.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. Lisa Roderick spent 22 years managing Denali Base Camp on the Kahelna Glacier, acting as flight control for glacier pilots, weather reporter, first responder, and more. As base camp manager, she shepherded thousands of flights and climbers in and out of one of the most extreme weather environments on Earth. Lisa talks about her upbringing, becoming a climber, her relationship with her climbing husband, Mark Westman, the National Park Service climbing rangers, and some of the many characters she met on the job. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer.
This is Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.
Channeling hope and promise through poetry.
If you've never seen leaping dolphins, it has to be some sort of celestial sign of hope. You have to be there to be ready to capture them, to remind humanity that there are those moments.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason.
This Friday at 8:30 p.m. on Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1, or alaskapublic.org.
This interview deals with the topic of suicide and death. Listener discretion is advised. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. I'm excited to have Lisa Roderick, author of A Place Among Giants, with us today. Lisa is joining me from her home in Talkeetna, Alaska via Zoom. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Oh, thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I really enjoyed your book. I breezed through it. It's a quick read, and there's a lot to it. Go ahead and give us a little summary of the book, if you don't mind.
Well, it's I'd say the heart of the book is my 22 seasons working up at base camp on Denali and kind of describing what I'm doing up there, job description. I described definitely a lot of things that happened up there. There was unfortunately a lot of tragedies, but also a lot of really great characters and people that I worked with up there, the pilots, the climbing rangers, climbers from all over the world. So as you can imagine, I have a lot of stories to tell about that. Also, I talk about how I got to Alaska because I grew up in Connecticut and that kind of journey and how I made it to Alaska. So I talk about my childhood, which my childhood was a little unusual. I grew up on a farm in Connecticut and we had a tennis court and a swimming pool. My dad was a construction worker. And so it was just lots of hard labor on the farm growing up. And I think that got me ready for living in Alaska. But anyways, just the journey of how I made it up to Alaska and then running an air service with my brother in Talkeetna and then eventually getting the base camp manager job, meeting my husband, who was a climber, and getting wrapped up in the whole climbing scene, doing some climbing myself. So I just kind of wanted, it didn't start off as a memoir. I just started writing things down kind of journal style. And then my husband said, hey, let's try to make this into something, you know, a book. And so that was daunting. But we spent a lot of time on this. I mean, it's 400 and something pages. Hopefully it goes by quickly. But so it's, yeah, it's my whole journey from my childhood up to Alaska running base camp for 22 seasons. Of course, there's a lot of history that wasn't being recorded, things that were going on up there, climbing and different airplanes, aviation changed quite a bit. Of course, the global warming. And so this is, I just felt like it needed to be documented and people's stories. I didn't want to forget these people. Some people, as you'll find out, didn't survive in the book. And so I kind of wanted to tell their story through my eyes, what I saw. And so, yeah, it talks a little bit about risk, about climbing, why do we climb, kind of just reflecting what climbing has changed into over the years. And yeah, it's kind of a roller coaster ride through all those 22 seasons.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a love story, too. And we were talking wanted to talk about the title and maybe the alternative title of it.
Well, you know, that's always the most challenging thing is when you decide to write a book. You kind of want to maybe add a little mystery in the title. You know, but you also want it to grasp somebody right away. And so I always obviously thought those mountains were huge. I came from Connecticut, never seen anything like this, the Alaska Range. And so obviously it's talking about the size of the mountains. They're giant, the tallest peak in North America. And just, the people that I'm working with were the pilots are on the top of their field, these glacier pilots. These climbers are, of course, you know, on the top of their game also. So I kind of thought, well, A Place Among Giants was obviously describing where I worked, but there's a lot more into it. I think that by working up there and dealing with that type of environment up at base camp, it kind of makes you a giant yourself in your field and what you're doing. And so I thought that the title kind of captured all that.
And one of the themes in the book is your relationship with your husband, too.
Yeah, that's a big part of the book. I did want to name the book Denali Base Camp, A Love Story.
Aww.
But nobody seemed to like that. But it definitely talks about a lot about me being the base camp manager, running Denali Base Camp, why my husband is out there climbing some of the hardest climbs in the Alaska Range, and how I kind of kept my sanity. I thought that maybe by being in the mountains and being close to him when he was doing these kinds of activities would be easier because I could keep in touch with him. But that is definitely up for debate. There's something about being at home and not knowing what's going on. And obviously, I'm dealing with life and death up there on Denali. So I know the harsh realities of climbing and, you know, aviating in this area. So, yeah, I think it made things harder on me. And I was always prone to worry anyways. So the book talks about that and the kind of the relationship that developed between Mark and I. And then eventually I started going climbing with him. And just because, you know, people that know mountain climbers know that that's all they want to do is climb. So I kind of felt like Barbara Washburn a little bit, that she said, I wanted to be with my husband. That's why I climbed. So to that extent is why I started climbing with him, just because that's all he was doing was planning climbing trips. We eventually got into scuba diving later. I told him that he was a little too one tracked and that we needed to expand our horizons a little bit. But so definitely talks a lot about Mark and his climbs and some of our climbs together.
For the listeners who don't know, Washburns were a very famous couple that pioneered climbs on Denali.
Barbara Washburn was the first woman to climb Denali with her husband.
Yeah. So you mentioned the farming. So let's go to your youth and how that influenced you. And there are some very poignant stories and sometimes a little difficult reading in the book. But I think it really influenced how you got to here. And actually, I thought about the farming part and how it really helped you manage base camp. But talk a little bit about your upbringing.
I grew up in rural Connecticut, and I grew up on a farm. And basically, we had about 15 acres. We had animals, cows, sheep, pigs, chickens. We had a huge garden. We had corn growing. We had honeybees. We tapped maple trees. We were extremely busy as children. My dad worked us pretty hard and kind of instilled a pretty serious work ethic. And I thought about that later and how that kind of prepared me for base camp, because there's lots of physical labor up there, carrying bags and dealing with deep snow and that kind of thing. And so I grew up in Connecticut. And it was a really great childhood. We had, my dad built a tennis court right in the middle of our field where our cows were. And my dad loved tennis. And my dad was also into classical French cooking. So we ate really well. We ate all our animals. We had always had a freezer full of meat, you know, obviously cow, sheep. And so that's just kind of the way I grew up. I thought that was pretty normal, just raising animals and then using them for meat. But I didn't realize it was unusual until I would have friends come over and we would discuss who we're eating tonight. And so our friends got a little freaked out about that.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that this was a hard part of the book. I didn't really want to include it, but my husband said, well, you need to tell your background. My mom had depression, and it's kind of, you know, in the 80s, nobody was really talking about it. And we didn't realize, I was 17, I was into my own world, you know, kind of breaking away from your parents, and didn't realize that my mom was depressed, and she ended up committing suicide, which we didn't see coming at all. I was pretty, of course, shaken up for a really long time. You know, we moved on the best we could with the family. We didn't really talk about it a lot. I have two brothers and my dad, so, you know, obviously just boys, and boys do things a little differently. They don't talk about a lot of their feelings. So we kind of just moved on. And Paul ended up going off to college. He went to an aeronautical university in Emory-Riddle in Arizona. And I quit high school. After 2 weeks into senior year, I said, I can't do this. I was pretty stressed out over everything. And so I ventured out on my own and moved out of the house and eventually got a job in banking. I was a teller. And so I worked in the banking system, working my way up, doing new accounts and that kind of thing. But there was always this nagging feeling that something was missing. So my childhood was always really exciting because my dad used to race cars. My brother, Mark, races motocross. And Paul had a little ultralight airplane that he was trying to get off. My dad even built him a runway. And so I was just kind of surrounded by a lot of adrenaline, excitement. You know, things are always happening. Anybody that grows up on a farm knows, like, the animals are getting out or things are happening or the coyotes are coming in the yard. So I just kind of grew up with lots of things going on around me. And but I just was, something nagged at me. So I decided to go out west. And being from the East Coast, we didn't really travel, you know, having the farm. So the West was kind of a mysterious place. And I decided to go to Boulder, Colorado. And I learned how to rock climb there. I put a note up on the North Face store looking for a partner. And I got really lucky. I found an older gentleman that was willing to take me under his wing and teach me how to rock climb. So we do a lot of, I climbed every weekend in El Dorado and all the canyon and in Boulder. And I started working as a travel agent. I thought I was going to travel the world. I didn't really want to do the banking thing anymore and traveling the world. But, you know, as anybody knows, it doesn't work out that way. You know, the rent in Boulder is, I had like four roommates and it's really, it was crazy just trying to make ends meet. And so I didn't get to travel the world like I thought. But so my brother, Paul, moved up to Alaska to fly airplanes. And so I came up to visit. Paul and I were really close. And so I came up to visit. And as soon as I landed in Anchorage, looked around at those mountains, the Chugach Mountains, and then eventually heading north to the Alaska Range and seeing all that, it just captured me. It was pretty incredible, like getting like hit on the head really hard. And as anybody that first moved to Alaska knows, it either the whole lifestyle Alaska makes sense to you or it doesn't. But it hit me right away. I'm like, this is where I want to be. And so I went back to Boulder and I started planning my strategy to get up to Alaska. And I packed up my pickup truck and I just started driving north. And I worked in Anchorage for a while. My brother's best friend was a chiropractor and she had offices all out in Bush, Alaska, out in Dillingham, Naknek, Nome, King Salmon. She was all over the place. So I traveled with her as her traveling office manager. So I got to see a lot of Alaska that way when I first moved up. But one weekend on some time off, I went to drive around the Kenai. And as soon as I drove into Cooper Landing, I was blown away by obviously the water and just the, I needed a sense of community. I didn't really have that in Anchorage. So I decided to move to Cooper Landing and I worked at the Kenai Princess as the tour. I was a tour, worked in the tour desk. And then I started doing a little river rafting and became a guide doing that and some hiking. And then in the winters, because Cooper Landing shuts down pretty much in the winter, I moved to Girdwood and I worked at the Alyeska when it first opened. I worked there. And so I did that. I went back and forth from Cooper Landing to Girdwood and did that for about three seasons. And then my brother called me up and he said, I'm buying this air service in Talkeetna that I'm working for, Talkeetna Air Taxi, and I need you to move here and help me run this thing. So I said, I don't know how to run an air service, but I will certainly help you out. So I moved to Talkeetna once again, packing up my pickup truck and heading to Talkeetna. And so just helped them the best I could run the air service. And one of the first climbers to walk in the door, I didn't really know a lot about mountain climbing. First climbers to walk in the door was Mark Westman and Joe Purrier. Mm-hmm. And they had some pretty big plans. They were going to do the South Buttress of Denali, a very seldom climbed mountain. And so I was pretty intrigued. And those guys got weathered in. And so this is when climbers actually stayed at the office and I was sleeping upstairs. So I got to know these guys pretty well. They got stuck for about 3 or 4 days because of weather. And then Mark got food poisoning by one of the local restaurants. And so I kind of had to nurse him a little bit. And then he obviously eventually went into the mountains. And then I didn't hear from him for about a month. And I was working late at Talkeetna Air Taxi and we had a CB radio and I hear the boys on the summit, Mark and Joe, and they were trying to get a hold of me and I just happened to be there. And so I got to talk to Mark and Joe when they made the summit of Denali.
Oh, that's fun.
So that was pretty exciting.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torlap. I'm talking to Lisa Roderick, author of A Place Among Giants. So you met Mark. I want to move ahead a little bit here. So how did the base camp manager position come about then?
I was working at Talkeetna Air Taxi, and Mark, we were doing a long-distance relationship, and he decided that we should move to Seattle. And so I moved to Seattle for a while and went to massage school and thought that's what I was going to do with my life. And then I moved back to Talkeetna. And Annie Duquette, the base camp manager, she was up there for about 10 seasons. We became good friends, and she decided she didn't want to run base camp. 10 years was enough of giving up her summers working on a glacier. So she thought I'd be a good fit. I was doing a little climbing, and I obviously worked for the air service, so I knew a little bit about, the plains and weather and that kind of thing. So I went and trained with her. That is in the book, my learning experience up there. Unfortunately, when I was left alone, Annie trained me for a while, and then I was left alone up there to run camp, and there was a tragedy. There was an airplane crash, And it wasn't anything that I did. It was just bad luck with the weather on the way in. After going through the airplane crash, I was like, I don't think I want to do this job. But then I started thinking about it. I'm like, well, what if I can make sure this never happens again? What if I can, help these pilots out the best I can? And so it kind of actually really solidified me wanting to go back up there. And then I ended up spending 22 seasons, longer than anyone up there. I spent more time in the Alaska Range than, if you add up all my days of I spent up there, it comes to almost 4 years.
Wow.
I spent living on a glacier.
Lisa, talk about the job a little bit, sort of like the job description and what you did as base camp manager.
Well, the base camp manager's prime focus is to do weather observations. So basically, we're living up there in a tent. We have a pretty sturdy tent. It's called the Weatherport. And so I get a crew of volunteers at the end of April, usually about third week of April. We go up, put my camp in. We set up my tent, all my electronics. I had a phone up there. It was called a radio telephone. And people used them in Bush, Alaska. And it worked actually really well up there. I pointed it towards Mount Foraker, my antenna, and it bounced off and somehow got a signal here in Talkeetna. And so I used that radio telephone to call the air services every day and let them know what the weather was doing. So I get up in the morning, I look outside, I get a report. So I have a weather station up there. So I tell them what the winds are doing, what the sky conditions are like, weather, what we call, is it flyable? Can the planes, because they're flying VFR, which is visual, and so they have to have 2 miles of visibility. They always have to be able to see the ground where they're landing. So I tell them whether it's flyable, what the glacier conditions are like. Are they going to be landing in deep snow? Is it wind blasted? Is it going to be hard, bumpy conditions? So I'll let them know what the landing's like. And then as they start bringing in climbers, I help unload the planes because weather can change pretty quick in the Alaska Range. So we got to get these planes unloaded and get everybody off the runway so the planes can operate. And so my job is safety around the airplanes and making sure everybody gets their gear off the runway so the next plane can land. And then I'm in charge of maintaining this glacier runway. So if we get, usually it was more than 6 inches of snow, I'd have to go out there with everybody that's waiting to fly. We go out there and we pack down the runway. We just have to do the takeoff side. They can land in deep snow, but then when they go to take off with a heavy load, we need to have it packed. So we have to go out there with our snowshoes or skis or whatever you have, and we go pack down the runway up and down. And so we have to keep maintaining that because obviously sometimes it snows for 3 days. So we're out there packing the runway a couple of times a day. And then when climbers are done with their climb, they check in with me and then I call their air service and then I book their flights out. So that's kind of what I'm doing up there. And then I'm also helping the National Park Service. I don't work for the National Park Service. I fall under the Air Service's concession to work in the National Park. So I work for the Air Services. All of the Air Services in Talkeetna collectively get together and hire the base camp manager. And my pay gets... Actually, the climbers pay a fee to the Air Service, and then that's where the money comes to run base camp. So, but I do assist the National Park Service, whatever they need. Obviously, I'm going to pick up trash. I'm going to help them keep caches buried when things start melting out so the ravens don't eat climbers' food. And then I assist if there's rescues going on, then I will help whatever I can do for the rangers.
That sounds like a busy time. And you're there April through mid-June, through the climbing season? Is that right?
The climbing season really gets going in May. So I'm there. I get in end of April and then May, June. And then usually by July now, the runway starts getting really all the snow starts melting off the glacier. So there's no cushion anymore for the airplanes. And so they're hitting – crevasses and things start getting too bumpy. So by mid-July, we're done. We're wrapped up now. The climbing season used to go quite a bit longer. When Francis Randall worked up there in the 70s and 80s, or in the 1980s, she definitely, her season went longer. And it went into August sometimes. People were up there climbing.
It's interesting to me that there's Francis Randall and then Andy Duquette and a new, and now there's a new young woman that's running it. So is it something about, is it the, a woman personality? Like is that just coincidence or is there something
I don't
about,
know. I get that question a lot. Why is it always women? Up until Gabby, when Gabby took over, we were all blonde too. I don't know what that was about, but so I don't know. I think the job requires a little bit of mothering, maybe. The climbers come back, they're exhausted from their climb, and, you know, I definitely take care of people up there. They're running low on food, if they need water. Base camp manager always has a jug of lemonade for climbers that just climbed Heartbreak Hill. And so, yeah, there's definitely a little bit of that going on, of taking care of people and having some compassion to people that are pretty spent from their climb. So, yeah, it's just always worked out well to, you know, to have a woman up there, I guess.
But you also, in the book, it comes across as some of those climbers, and maybe you can explain a little bit why this is, they're ready for a shower and a beer and a burger, right? And so for those people who don't understand that need to get out of there, like how much stress that can entail. Yeah.
Very interesting. You would think climbers are in the mountains because they love the mountains. They want to be there. But something happens when they get to base camp. I think that the realities of everything start coming back. Their trip is over. They are dreaming of cheeseburgers and showers and beer, maybe getting back on the internet again. And then the stresses of, you know, a lot of foreign climbers. So they have flights to catch. They, you know, have all this stress with getting themselves back home. And I think that just starts hitting people at base camp. And so they get really impatient. Not everybody, but a lot of climbers, you definitely kind of remember the people that are not nice to you, I think, which is, which probably isn't good. But instead of, I've had so many people that were amazing to me and helped me out around camp and brought me gifts from their home countries. And I feel like I've definitely been spoiled up there. But then there's a few climbers out of every bunch that comes down that just can't handle the weight. And they start pacing. They refuse to set up their tents. They don't want to spend another night. And the weather's not cooperating. If the, you know, if it's storming, then the planes aren't coming. They're flying VFR. And so I tell them, go set up your tents. And they just won't do it. They can't handle the reality of setting up their tent, eating another freeze-dried meal again. And so they start losing it. It's interesting. I don't like to call upon any nationalities, but there are certain nationalities that were more impatient than others. So I won't go into that. But so I think that maybe they're used to having more access to the mountains and, you know, helicopters and that kind of thing. So they don't have to wait. And the average storm on Denali lasts about 3 days. So we're pretty guaranteed to probably have about 3 days of unflyable weather during a storm. So I talk about that in the book, some of the impatient people and kind of what I went through. So I had to, in the beginning, I was just super nice and trying to be understanding and feeling for them because I've been stuck in the Alaska Range. But then I realized that, no, that didn't work very well, because then next thing you know, they want to be inside my heated tent. They want me to feed them. And so I had to find this balance of being firm and telling them the way it is and having to walk away and being nice. And so there's no reason you can't be nice, but you also have to be firm. Like, sorry, you have to wait. Go set up your tent. I'll come and find you when the weather clears. And that's the end of this conversation, and then I walk away.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordak. We're talking to Lisa Roderick and about her job as Denali Base Camp Manager up on the Kehoma Glacier. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Hi, this is Jess Jang, an editor for Planet Money, and you're listening to KSKA Anchorage, Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
Our diverse city is filled with creatives doing amazing things. But even as a resident, you can only scratch the surface of what Anchorage has to offer. Tune in to Alaska Public Media for State of Art, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. Join me, Ammon Swenson, as I interview local artists, play homegrown music, and tell you about upcoming events. That's State of Art, Fridays at 8 p.m. on Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1. Or tell your smart speaker to play KSKA.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordak, on Alaska Public Media. I'm here with Lisa Roderick talking about her book, A Place Among Giants, about her stories and experiences as a Denali Base Camp manager for 22 years. That's impressive. So, Lisa, you saw a lot up there and probably a lot of happy climbers, and then there was some challenges and tragedies. And so let's talk about that here for a bit, because that had been difficult to deal with. Talk about your experience of climbing and why people are doing it and sort of the risks and rewards involved.
There's one chapter called Peril in the Beauty. And yeah, there is definitely lots of rewards to climbing, but obviously there's going to be some risks. And but I think that people are climbing, you get in a different mindset when you're in the mountains, as you know. And I think when you're in the mountains, it kind of strips everything down to pretty, it makes things a lot simpler. And we don't have all this stuff coming at us like we do in the real world. And I think it slows everything down and it just becomes a meditation when you're up there of just putting one foot in front of the other, carrying loads. You can't really be distracted when you're climbing. So you really have to stay in the present. And I think that after spending a lot of time in the present, your mind starts to just strip everything down to its basic needs. And so it's definitely a form of meditation being in the mountains. You don't have a lot of, kind of that outside distractions that social media and that kind of thing can, or politics can hit you. And then you have a really amazing partnership. And with your partner, your climbing partner, obviously it's you're putting each other's lives in your hands. And so that's a pretty powerful thing for sure. So I think just being around climbers, they definitely have this gleam in their eye, like they've seen something that a lot of us don't get to see by being in the mountains for long periods of time.
You have a reading for us, I think, sort of about that topic. You want to read?
Yeah, I could do a reading, Why I Think People Climb. I love this. It's by Rene DeMaul, and this is a quote. People ask me all the time, why do people climb? Why would they do that? It's dangerous. It's so many things can go wrong, but this is what he has to say about it. You can't stay on the summit forever. You have to come down again. So why bother in the first place? Just this. What above knows what is below, but what is below does not know what is above. One climbs, one sees, one descends, one sees no longer, but one has seen. So I think that kind of wraps it up. It's when you climb something, you don't ever look at it the same way. You know what it took to get up that mountain. You see things differently. You now know what is above. And I think that's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And I also think you had a reading sort of a little bit about the beauty and some thoughts about sort of the beauty and risk that come with that.
Yeah, here's a part in the book. There is a dynamic paradox in our relationships to places like these. What I already understood to be true with alpinism now seems to be true for aviation. The dangers and the beauty of these mountains are inexplicably bonded, and the same attributes which attract so many to these environments are also a source of peril. Wild places such as these possess a unique capacity to humble. They bring one face to face with the fragility and transcendence of life. The mountains have so much to teach, and yet so much capacity to take. The hardest lesson of all, however, is when the mountains take, they often take big. And that is in the part of the book right after the plane crash that happened with the National Park Service. That was my observations after that happened.
So you were at the base camp. You weren't in charge of search and rescue. The Park Service is there. They have patrols and other people at base camp. Talk about that relationship, like how you were involved in those. And in particular, seeing these climbers go off and then knowing that, you know, some of them might not come back.
Yeah, that's definitely the reality up there is, you know, you get to know these climbers and then they're off climbing Denali. Then you don't see them for 3 weeks and sometimes they don't come back. And it's just so important to have these rangers up there. These rangers are doing, they started in 1995 doing orientations and talking to each climbing party that went up there and just answering questions, showing them a PowerPoint presentation, you know, about traveling on a glacier and that kind of thing. And so after doing these briefings, the National Park Service found that a lot of the accidents started going down. So these briefings were really helpful. And so that's how you start off climbing Denali. You go into the ranger station, get your briefing, you come up, and then there's rangers stationed up on the mountain in different elevations on the mountain. They have a tent at 14,000, and so the rangers will hang out there, and then they'll go up high on the mountain assisting, cleaning up trash, dealing, unfortunately, with human waste, and they're there for search and rescue. We have an A-Star helicopter that's contracted for the season. And so they end up using that when the weather's good to do rescues. They can do what's called short haul, where they put a climbing ranger on a 200-foot line that's attached to the helicopter, and then they can fly that ranger to the hurt climber, and then they can get them help right away. And then sometimes they'll just clip off to the hurt climber by their harness, and then they fly with them. And then so I've received a lot of patients coming in that way on the line to base camp. So I would help the rangers any way that I could, whether it was just carrying a litter to maybe Life Med, because Life Med would land at base camp. I had hurt climbers in my tent. If we had more than, you know, a few hurt climbers, then I would put them in my tent, in my heated tent. And I had pretty, I was a first responder, so I had some medical training. And also, I've actually done CPR up there before. And then there's obviously a lot of air traffic up there. So when the helicopter is on a rescue mission, I would talk to the pilots in the surrounding area and let them know there's a mission going on and to stay away from certain areas and just make sure there wasn't any conflicts with the rescue helicopter and the fixed wing aviation that was going on, you know, sightseeing and that kind of thing. So that could take some pressure off the helicopter pilot.
Wow, that's amazing. You're like air traffic control. You're a medic, first responder. You're, I don't know, like a tour, like a control person on the ground, a weather person, right? You're probably paying close attention to the weather. So and host all at once.
Yes.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of talking about weather. As anybody that's climbed Denali, they want to know what the weather's going to do. We do get weather reports from the National Weather Service, and they do the best they can with these weather reports, but obviously, you know, they're not always accurate. But I read the weather at 8 o'clock every night to the climbers. I broadcast it. I used to broadcast it on a CB radio, and now we use these family band radios. But so every night, everybody turns their radios on, no matter where they are on the mountain, and I broadcast the 8 o'clock, what we call the 8 o'clock weather. And it's a 5-day National Weather Service forecast on Denali.
back to the Rangers and you're working with the Park Service, some people might say, I'm sure they've said this, why have that? Why have all this infrastructure there? I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot of resources going on. You're there.
It
you
is.
Have a pack. You have the Park Service has a personnel stationed at base camp and at 14 and patrols. They have a helicopter. It's wilderness. Why should we justify this?
Well,
the resources?
Yeah, people ask me that all the time. It's, you know, it's a very small budget, if you think about it, compared to a lot of other activities like boating in national parks or, you know, snow machining around Alaska. You know, what it goes in hiking and what it goes into searching for, you know, missing boaters and hikers, it's absolutely nothing compared to the Denali rescue budget. Usually, unfortunately, when people go missing on Denali, it's, you know, usually a day or two search because there's the chance of survival on a mountain like Denali after being missing for a couple of days. So it's not like being, you know, on the other side of the park where you can search for somebody for a week if they go missing with hiking. But I just think it's really important to brief climbers that are coming up there on waste management. People that climb on Denali, you know, come obviously from all over the world, and they say that it's one of the cleanest mountains they've ever been to. And so the rangers are just really important to instill that resource management. Let's keep this mountain clean. Let's make a great climbing experience for everybody that goes up there. Roger Robinson came up with the Clean Mountain Cans. And that's a very successful program of people containing human waste. And so it's not, you know, disgusting up there like it used to be. So the rangers, and then to have somebody that's highly skilled, they're all EMTs. They all have search and rescue experience. They know how to short haul. They know how to do helicopter stuff. They know rigging. They all take classes rigging for rescue. And so they're very, very skilled individuals that are going up there. And we have an amazing volunteer program. And it's Denali Rescue Volunteers. And so we take highly skilled people that want to volunteer their time and help us out on Denali. So they go on patrols. They do base camp patrols. They do what we call 14 patrols, where they're actually climbing the mountain and helping the rangers. And that's just a really important program to have those volunteers up there.
Yeah, and a few years ago, we did a show on the Denali Rescue Volunteers with Steve Mock.
Nice.
Let's talk about people a bit. And I want to start with your husband. And I want to start with, like, it's such a big part of the book, your relationship and his evolution of the climber. He climbed some amazing things. And it sort of was one of the tensions in the book of and it's just not him, but others, friends of yours, going off and you having to be at base camp waiting for their return. And that had to have been difficult. How did you manage that?
It was very, very difficult. Definitely, gosh, when I first started working up at base camp, I smoked cigarettes and I would roll drum tobacco up there. That helped me with my stress. My husband would be up climbing. Let's say he was on the Moonflower buttress, and I can get a spotter scope and watch him climb and, you know where he was, his progress. We would check in with each other by radio every night. There was a couple of times he didn't check in with me when he was supposed to. We had a couple of misunderstandings up there, which is in the book, but, it was really, stressful knowing that he's up there climbing, but I married a climber. This is what you're in for. I was just in the mountains with him and knew what was going on. So that was definitely gave me some gray hairs for sure.
And then some other people, we talk about the Glitter Girls. You want to talk about them?
Oh, the Glitter Girls. Yeah, that was tragic. The two, Karen McNeil and Sue Knott, two amazing women, climbers at the top of their game, and they wanted to go climb Mount Forker by an extremely hard route called the Infinite Spur. And Mark and Joe already climbed let's see, who did Mark climb this? No, he climbed it with Joe.
Yep.
And so we knew it was going to be a challenging route, but the girls were up for it. And they already had a little bit of an epic on the Cassine, which is a hard route up Denali. And they didn't have a radio, so they couldn't check in with us to let us know they were okay on the Cassine. So they ended up searching for them, and the girls weren't very happy about that. So when they were going up the spur, they said they weren't going to take a radio. And I made them take a radio. I'm like, take this little thing, check in with me, just check in with me, just to let me know you're okay. I got to know these girls really well. So they headed off to Foraker, and we never saw them again. So that whole story is in the book. And after that happened, I would be looking down on the glacier, and I would always think that I'd see two figures walking up the glacier and that they would come back, but they never did. They were lost. They must have got caught in a storm and got blown off the mountain. We did find Sue's backpack that was on the base of the route, so she obviously dropped her backpack, which had the radio in it. They emergency hired Mark Westman, my husband, to be, since he's climbed the route before, to go in the helicopter and search for them. And this is before he became a ranger. And they thought they saw some footprints up high, but there's really nothing was ever found with the girls. There was never a recovery.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordock. I'm talking with Lisa Roderick about her book, A Place Among Giants, 22 Seasons at Denali Base Camp. You know, we tend to think about and focus on some of the tragedies, but boy, there are all kinds of successful stories of climbs and people really having life-changing experiences up there.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Talk a little bit about
I've
that.
I've met some very... very exceptional people up there. You know, like I said, climbers from all over the world. And boy, just to see them when they get back from Denali, they are, you know, hammered in the best possible way. They've definitely seen what it takes to climb Denali, the beauty of Denali. And so people are on quite a high when they get back. And so it can be a very fun atmosphere. You know, we would used to have sled races at base camp, and we would play. We brought up a badminton set, and we would play frisbee. And of course, I got to know the rangers very well, living with them up at base camp. And so we would do dinners every night with the rangers. I got to work with amazing people like Daryl Miller. He would check in with me all the time. Even though I wasn't one of his rangers, he checked in with me. He would call me at night and just to see if I needed anything. And then, of course, I loved my time with Roger Robinson up there. He always had the setup patrol. And so I got to spend a couple weeks with him at the beginning of the season. And all the rangers up there just became really close with them.
You know, we talked about the people, but at some point you had seen a lot. You've been there 22 years, and that must have taken a toll on you. And and what point do you, I think all of us who are in careers of one sort or another have to make that decision of when to move on. Let's talk about that. I think we have a reading for us, too.
Yeah, after 22 seasons, obviously, you know, anybody would start getting a little burnt out, spending their summers up in a cold environment on Denali. And as we all know, these summers in Alaska are pretty precious. And I feel like, oh, I gave up enough of the summer. So And then also, I always was always looking for someone as my possible replacement. And I thought I found a couple of people, but, you know, they lived out of state, and it never, they always have to fly up here to do this 3-month job. So I started narrowing my search to a local, and I found Gabby Farrow. I actually used to babysit her. Her father built my house, and she was little and when he was doing that. So anyways, I've known her for a long time, and so I decided to ask her, and she was pretty psyched. So she's been doing it for a couple seasons now and doing a great job. So that was just what a weight off to find somebody to take over the job for me. And, you know, I don't know if she's going to do it for 22 seasons, but it's just great having her up there. She really loves the mountains, and she's doing a great job. So, oh, I lost my page on what I was going to read. I took the marker out, and now I can't find it. Kind of about letting go. Oh, here's moving on. Okay. When you're up there working on Denali, it's not all excitement all the time. There's lots of downtime. When the weather's bad, the planes aren't flying, everybody's stuck and they're waiting. And so there's lots of times where you're really trying to, you know, pass the days up there and sitting in a tent. And I always feel like I was missing out. Like, what's going on in Talkeetna? Oh, I should be out on the lake doing something. So I'm sitting up here on a glacier, and you can't really move around a lot in the late season because the glaciers get so bad, it's so easy to fall into a crevasse. So you're kind of stuck in your tent. So I just kind of started getting burned out. Climbers, actually, things up there started changing. A lot of my friends left. Mark wasn't working as a ranger up there anymore. And a lot of climate change and just a lot of warm weather. And so, yeah, there's definitely a lot of isolation up there. And here's a passage here about moving on towards the end of the book. My companions depart camp the following day, leaving me to a string of days in solitary confinement. A week passes. These late season days run together in a blur of repetition that I recognize all too well. I put an X on the calendar with every midnight sunset, hard on the heels of those long afternoons marked by silence, save for the occasional visit of a scenic flight, the calls of the ravens, the rush of the snow avalanches, or a volley of stones ricocheting down some nearby face. I have much time to reflect, and I'm consumed by altering waves of joy and nostalgia. It's hard to let go of the identification, the memories, the moments of excitement and action Denali has provided, but the mountain also subjects me to much isolation, along with physical stresses of my aging body and the emotional trauma and tragedies that deprives me of so much time away from the people that I love. This existence is not sustainable anymore. It's been a wild ride, but it's time to get off and move on. So that's kind of how I just started thinking that it was such an incredible job. It's very unique, and it was time to pass it along to the younger generation.
You write in the book about how people go, oh, this is the most incredible job. You have the most amazing thing. On one hand, yeah. On the other hand, there are a lot of challenges and a lot of tragedy and a lot of sorrow and loss. And I think that's in the outdoor industry, that's a common theme. And I wonder, it seems like for you, and especially the alpine climbing community, that there's got to be a degree of PTSD and build up that we don't talk about a lot in this field. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think it's a cumulative, just one tragedy after another. I mean, I had one season that, oh, was it 9 people died up on Denali? And that was in the chapter rescue season. Just one thing after another, just when you think, oh, what else could go wrong? Yeah, things did. And so it definitely takes its toll on you. You don't realize that you're kind of in this constant state of stress up there.
Yeah.
Too many things are happening. And yeah, I did unfortunately have 2 pretty major plane disasters, one with the National Park Service, one with a friend, Kelly, that was coming in mm-hmm. to drop off climbers. And so in my 22 years, I did see two fatal accidents, and that took its toll on me, especially when I'm up there trying to keep these pilots safe and they have problems coming into the mountains. People don't realize, well, yeah, there's a base camp manager up there telling them what the weather's doing, but I can only tell them what I'm seeing. I can tell them what the weather's doing at base camp. They still have 20, 30 minutes of flying to get into the mountains, and they have passes that they have to go through. And so I can't keep, you know, I can't see what's going on when they're flying in. So things definitely can happen. But I got to the point where I got an autoimmune disorder and called Hashimoto's. I always had thyroid problems, but I think that that was a cumulative of all the stress of mark climbing, the all the different tragedies that happened up there. It took its toll on my body. And a little bit of arthritis. And so it's time to take care of myself
pass
now.
It on. And I think probably the community, you talk a lot about the people and how important the people are, and not only your husband, but your friends. And I imagine that's a huge source of comfort, being able to share out your feelings and the stresses.
Yeah, I couldn't have done it that long if it wasn't for the community up there and just really amazing people that, you know, a lot of people helped me out up there. I've had a lot of volunteers through the years that would work up there with me and give me breaks so I could go out and get a shower. And I've had, you know, friends. Allison was a big help. She would come up there and help me out. And Sandra, there's just a lot of people that helped me out through the years. And the pilots would bring me little comforts. Yeah. And so that was nice.
Let's wrap this up with one memorable moment. What is something that, like, I mean, I know that's probably so many of them, but like, for instance, I like the bear walking up the glacier. I mean, that to me unbelievable.
You never thought that was going to happen. I was sitting up there at base camp. I was talking to Vern Tejas. He was cooking dinner for his folks, and I had my aircraft radio, and a pilot said, "Lisa, there's a bear walking up the runway." And wow. I did a double take, and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. What is a bear doing in the Alaska Range on a glacier? And so I actually ran down Heartbreak Hill a little bit to get a glimpse of this bear. And at that time, a plane was taking off and scared the bear. And so I just got a quick glimpse of it running around Annie's Ridge, and I probably fell into a crevasse. I don't know. Nobody ever saw that bear again. So I just shudder to think of what would have happened if a bear came into base camp. We got all this buried food up there. Yeah. There's like, what are we going to do?
That's a great story and a great way to end this interview. I've been interviewing Lisa Rodrick, the author of Place Among Giants. There's so many great stories in this book. I really enjoyed it a great deal. Thank you for joining us, Lisa.
Oh, thanks so much, Paul. It was great chatting with you.
Thanks to my guest, Lisa Rodrick, author of A Place Among Giants. Also, thanks to our producer, Tobin Shelby, with additional help from Ammon Swenson. I'm your host, Paul Twardock, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, enjoy the mountains from above or below, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Alaska Public.
Programming on KSDP is supported by the Schumigan Corporation. Located in Sand Point, the Schumigan family of businesses includes property and equity management, the Sand Point Tavern, the Anchor Inn Motel, and the Anchor Inn Lounge. The Schumigan Corporation, serving its shareholders and the people of Sand Point, on the web at www.schumigan.com or by telephone at 907-383-3525. The Schumigan Corporation, hometown values and service, a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sand Point, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay.